Get your advanced PhD in WOW from Floor and Decor. If you're a pro, you're already an expert in tile, wood, and stone. And with Floor and Decor's job site delivery, their free design services, and pro rewards that actually reward you, your business is set to grow from one client to the next. Floor and Decor isn't just a couple of aisles. It's an entire store designed to help your business boom. It's Floor and Decor.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. So, since I started the site back in 2008, I've read a lot of books on men's style. And one of the most fun, engaging, witty books I've read on the topic, as well as just crammed with useful, practical information, is a book that was published a few years ago called Men's Style, The Thinking Man's Guide to Dress. It's by a Canadian columnist and novelist by the name of Russell Smith, and I wanted to get him on the podcast to discuss all things men's style. So today on the show, Russell and I discuss sort of all aspects of style, sort of the high-level philosophical approach to men's style, why you should care about dressing, the history of men's style, why throughout history, most of human history, the most manliness of men were concerned about how they appeared and how they looked. And it's only recently where this whole aesthetic of, like, I just don't care came to approach. And we argue, like, why you should care even today. We discuss the future of men's style, but we also get brass tacks and talk about the practical aspects of style, the type of suit you should buy if you've never bought a suit and you're in the market for one, why you should invest in a good pair of shoes, shirts, things like that. Really great information that you can take away and apply right away, but also some things for you to think about as well. So without further ado, Russell Smith and Men's Style. Russell Smith, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So you wrote a book, came out about 3 years ago, called Men's Style, The Thinking Man's Guide to Dress. And it's one of the most information-packed book on style, but also the most well-written book. It's just a lot of fun to read. But I'm curious, because you highlight this in your book, that growing up, you were part of the punk rock scene. So I imagine there was a lot of studded denim jackets with sleeves ripped off and, you know, all, rancid patches, you know, sewn on and whatnot. And then now you're a writer, so you probably work from home. You don't have to get dressed up, technically. You could lounge around in your underwear. So I'm curious, how did this interest in high men's style and fashion get started?
Well, first of all, about punk rock, I mean, that was primarily a fashion interest. I mean, I think punk rock was primarily an aesthetic movement. It was really a movement about a new aesthetic, a movement in fashion. I don't really think it was a particularly not in the UK, which was the movement that influenced me the most. Not really a political or ideological movement. So I came to punk rock through fashion, really. But I'll tell you, my background is interesting. My father is a university professor of English. My mother, they met at Oxford in the 1950s, and she was a noted beauty. And so she always had an interest in clothes to look good. So I grew up with these two influences in my home. My house had a subscription to the Times Literary Supplement and Vogue. Those were the two biggest influences in my life. And my dad was always fascinated by the minutiae of men's clothing, not so much fashion as convention. You know, convention in men's fashion is so much more important than it is in women's fashion. The convention of how to do things properly and as a gentleman should are so riven with class conventions and military traditions. Those things are actually at odds with fashion, and they keep hold men's clothing back against fashion. My dad, he was from South Africa, which is where I was born, and he went to Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar, and so was slightly outside the privileged classes at Oxford had a different accent, a colonial accent, and really had to learn these conventions of proper gentleman's behavior in a place that was highly class conscious. So he learned all these conventions of the right dinner jacket, the right way to lace your shoes, to button your jackets, the right kinds of suspenders, what to call the third piece of your suit and how to pronounce it. And he taught all those things to me as a child. So I grew up fascinated by these things.
Interesting. And you, I guess the punk rock thing was just like you're going to rebel against that. Was that?
Well, it wasn't rebelling. No, really, it was all part of that. You know, for me, punk rock was rebelling against blandness. Punk rock was a way of being a peacock and standing out. So it was really just another manifestation of fashion. And after punk rock, as a very young man, I went through all the different post-punk new wave manifestations of different fashions, you know, rockabilly and ska and goth and new romantic. I had long hair and makeup and scarves. Those were all just different expressions of different forms of flamboyance, really.
Right. Yeah,
I don't dress like that anymore.
I think it's interesting. You make the point about how even people who are in the punk rock scene are very fashion conscious, because I guess the general idea out there from the most public is like, oh, they don't care what they look like, just look at them.
Oh God.
But
yeah, not well. In the 1970s, it was very much about how you look. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, well, even I was in high school in the 90s, and I was sort of dabbled in the punk ska scene, and I remember just seeing like people, these kids, like how much time they would spend like studying their jacket or like getting the patches right. So like, I mean, it looked like they didn't care, but no, they really cared a lot.
There's a lot of work that goes into it. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So in the book, you make the case that style and caring about dressing well, at least for men, gets attacked or is held in suspect by both people who would call themselves conservative socially or liberal or progressive. Right. So what are the respective criticisms and how do you counter those?
Well, it's funny. It's pretty much the same from the left and the right. The right says that it is uncool, unmanly to pay attention to your clothing, that it's effeminate. That's what a social conservative would think. A leftist thinks that it is frivolous, that it is not serious, that it's evidence of a wastefulness, a wasteful kind of thinking, again, evidence of a lack of seriousness. We have this convention in our society, and this is pretty recent. It's only in 20th century society, that a man should be valued only on what he does and not on how he appears, and that any kind of preening or flamboyant appearance makes him seem less serious and less powerful. That's really a blip in history, in the history of men's clothing. Men, especially powerful men, have signaled their power through finery right through human history. And even the most macho of warriors, military men, have the most flamboyant uniforms. Think of plumed helmets and red uniforms and all the different gold braid that goes into military uniforms. Those are really the most flamboyant outfits of all, or those are the most macho men. Think of kings and nobles showing off their status with silk and lace and finery. It really wasn't until the rise of democracy in the 19th century that men began to try to appear as if they were below their social station. It was something of a liability after the French Revolution in Europe to go around proclaiming aristocratic status. And it became more fashionable to appear to be a commoner. And that's when the rise of the uniform garment began, the kind of matching jacket and pants of a dark fabric that became the men's suit. And that began its rise in Europe in the early 19th century. And from about the mid-19th century on, it hasn't changed. It's a standard garment that is a manifestation of democracy. It's all men dress the same so that we cannot tell the class differences among them. That was how it arose. And really, in the it wasn't until the mid 20th century, and really the counterculture of the 1960s, that this idea began to arise that the natural man was the most manly man. That is, a man who didn't pay any attention to his grooming, who didn't shave, who let his hair grow, and who didn't care about his appearance. That was came hand in hand with the valuing of nature, of back to the land. And even before that, if you think of male icons of the 1930s or even the 1950s, if you think of Cary Grant, if you think of Sean Connery as James Bond, the masculine ideal there was not just a man who was competent and masculine and also maybe violent like James Bond, but who was also sophisticated, who wore a nicely fitted suit, who shaved, who knew something about opera and which wine to pair with fish. That was a masculine ideal, the idea that one could be elegant and sophisticated and manly at the same time, that kind of died in the 1960s. And again, that's, if you think of human history, that's just a tiny little blip. And of course, now we're getting back to the idea that men can be elegant and sophisticated and manly at the same time. I think finally, the all-natural movement of the 60s and 70s is dying.
Wearing itself out. Because I guess it seems like, and you talk about this in the book, as far as men's style go, and style in general, there seems to be just, it goes in, like it's a pendulum, right? It'll, one generation will rebel against the other. So I guess the baby boomers were rebelling against their Brooks brothers, wearing dads, right?
Parents.
So I know a lot of men who think that, still think that though, they're still in that natural man mode. They think, why bother, right? Why do you think, you know, why is it important to care how you dress? I mean, so why do you think a man should care how he dresses? And you make a case, I think is interesting, is that you say that our clothes are a form of art and gift to others. How so?
Right. I think that you dress out of respect to people around you, and you dress not just for yourself, but to make the people around you feel valued. If I am dressing carelessly or slavishly in the presence of people around me, it gives them a subtle, perhaps unconscious idea that I don't take them awfully seriously. If I dress up to be in the presence of others, I dress up, I don't mean I'm always going to be wearing a bow tie. I just mean that I dress cleanly and elegantly, as if I've made a choice for them. Then they feel valued and they feel respected. And that goes for events that you go to as well. If you dress well to go to a certain place, it shows respect for that place. On a more practical level for one's own, on a more selfish level, it helps one immensely to dress well in life because people simply treat you better. They treat you differently. And you can do this experiment. I mean, you can go to a police station wearing a hoodie and ask for help, or you can go wearing a suit and tie and ask for help, and you'll see what happens. People wearing a suit and tie are treated with more deference. They are treated with more respect. People come to them to take the lead in the crisis. You may deplore that. You may think it's a bad thing. And maybe it is, but still we could use it to our advantage.
And, I mean, do you, like, you work from home, I imagine. Do you get up and wear a coat and tie every day?
No, I don't. No, I don't. And, you know, I'm wearing the hoodie as I talk to you right now from my study. And it's funny, I crave an excuse to wear nice clothes. And I do. I have a sort of opposite schedule from everybody else because I work at home. What happens is when I finish my work day at 5 or 6 o'clock, that's when I shave and shower, and that's when I put on a jacket and tie and I go out. So it's kind of the opposite of everyone who's coming home at that time, taking that off. But I very much look forward to that moment. You know, there's a great anecdote it's a scene in Heart of Darkness by Joseph Conrad. When the narrator is first progressing down the river into the jungle, and in Africa, and the foliage starts getting dense and the heat starts getting oppressive and they start leaving civilization behind. They come to the last outpost of Belgian civilization, and it's a telegraph hut, a telegraph operator in the jungle, deep in the jungle, employed by the Belgian colonists. And he comes out to meet the boat, and he lives alone in this hut in the jungle, and he's wearing a dark suit and starched collar and tie in this intolerable heat. And the narrator wonders, why would he do that all day long there, sitting alone in the jungle? But the narrator reflects that in the vast degeneration of the land was character. That's a kind of a funny European belief that I think is sort of deep in all of us, that we dress ourselves up as armor to fight off the decay and entropy around us. Right. I kind of like that idea.
I like that idea too. And I feel too, not only when I dress up well, like do others treat me differently, but like I think of myself differently. I take myself a little more serious.
Yes. Than when exactly. I'm, yeah.
So there's days.
I'm happier. I'm just happier when I'm well dressed. I just feel I can deal with anything. I do feel that it's a kind of armor that protects me.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's days. I work from home too, so I'm typically wearing t-shirts and jeans. But when I'm in that mode, like I got to get stuff done. Like I'll dress up. And
it helps. And there's a psychological boost that it gives you. And I'll tell you something else too that's important for men as they age to remember, because I'm middle-aged, I'm 52 years old, and I am very nervous about looking silly trying to carry off casual or hipster clothes at this age. I think that one's ability to dress in casual clothes declines as one gets older, because one doesn't quite have the perfect body and one doesn't have the youthful glow. And so a clever t-shirt and running shoes is not as sexy on a middle-aged man with gray hair. And so I think that it really helps one as one grows older to start moving into finer and finer quality and slightly dressier clothes. You know, I haven't given up on social life. I still like going out to nightclubs where people are generally quite a bit younger than me. And my God, I certainly still want to be attractive to young women, but I am not going to do it by dressing like a kid. If I'm going to go to a nightclub where people are largely going to be younger than me, I may well be the only person in a fitted navy suit and tie. And that's fine with me, because then I am being exactly who I am. I'm not trying to pretend I'm someone else. People can say, oh, that's the older guy, and that's cool. And I feel much more confident than if I'm simply trying to fit in with everybody else.
Gotcha. So throughout the book, you mentioned that like sensuality as a quality that you should try to convey with your clothes, which I think is interesting, because like whenever I dress, I don't even think about, am I looking sensual? So why is that a quality men should be comfortable expressing?
Well, yeah, and it's a tricky one, because so much men's fashion traditionally is against sensuality, right? The main goal of the standard men's business suit is not sensuality; it's to express sobriety, which is a bit at odds. And if you think of the dark colors that are standard in men's suiting, charcoal, navy, and black. These come from a long tradition of professions that are meant to express sobriety. If you think, for example, of the priesthood, priests from various religions around the world wear black as an expression of asceticism and sobriety, a kind of distance from the pleasures of the world. In other words, an anti-sensuality. So where in this uniform do we find a window in which to express sensuality? Well, in fabrics, the fabrics of men's suits are extremely soft and delicate and silk-like these days, in crisp cotton, and in the little details, the tie in particular. You know, the tie is such a weird thing. It's such a useless, practically a completely useless garment, the tie. The tie has no practical role whatever. It is purely aesthetic. It actually evolved from a scarf. In the 17th century, scarves were the simplest way for people to keep their shirt closed at the neck. Buttons were actually quite expensive, and so there were eyelets in the shirt, which you would pull over your head, the V-neck, and then you'd hold it closed with a scarf. And people, particularly soldiers, started to develop more and more elaborate ways of tying these knots of their scarves so that they show off these knots. And that's where we get the origin of the tie. It gradually evolved. But now we don't need it to keep our shirts closed. We just need it because it's the only bit of color and a very feminine kind of fabric, silk, in this otherwise closed off, sober outfit. And the tie is just like this little window on your soul, because the rest of your body is completely covered up.
And what about, I guess, pocket squares would be another way?
pocket squares would be another way, socks, cufflinks. And of course, men's shoes are so luxurious too. I mean, they're extremely expensive, and what you're showing off when you're wearing these shoes is a kind of a handcrafted solidity. You know, you want to show a little bit of luxury with your shoes, but in such a subtle way. You know, people who don't know anything about shoes don't realize how expensive they are. They don't realize what kind of labor goes into them. So that's a kind of very subtle expression of luxury.
Well, speaking of shoes, you advocate spending a lot on shoes.
Yeah, I don't advocate spending a lot of money on clothes generally. I think one can get away with a very limited budget, and I do, having lived as a freelance writer for many years. Shoes is the one thing I don't think you can skimp on, because shoes are really the fundament of your outfit. They're like the root from which the whole outfit grows. And again, people who are class conscious, and that tends to be people who come from the privileged classes, are the ones who notice class differences and signifiers, not people who don't come from those classes. That's the trick of it. They recognize certain shibboleths. And so they will note your shoes right away. The other thing is, if you spend a lot of money on shoes, they'll last many years, and they tend not to go in and out of fashion the way shapes do. And so it's really worth your while.
It's wedding season, and while weddings are all about the bride and groom, they're also a chance for you to look your best. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into wedding season looking like $1 million, even though suits start at just $499. It's easier than ever to be the best dressed with Indochino. Order your custom suits now, and they'll be ready for wedding season. The process of customizing a suit on Indochino, very easy to do. It's also a lot of fun. I've talked about my navy blue suit I've gotten from Indochino. First off, you can decide how the jacket is, how you want the pockets on the jacket to be, how you want the lapels, the vent on the back, the lining on the pants. You can decide you want pleats or no pleats. I went no pleats on my pants on this one. And then you do the measuring process. You'll need someone to help you, but they have this very easy-to-follow guide. Send that all in a few weeks, you have a custom made-to-measure suit sent directly to your door, and you're going to pay about the same price for a suit that you'd pay for an off-the-rack suit at a department store. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code MANLINESS to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com, promo code MANLINESS. Check it out today. Spring is here and the McKays are going to be really busy. I'm coaching flag football again. My daughter's playing basketball. And on those nights when we don't have time to cook a full meal and clean up, we like to eat Factor meals. Factor meals are ready-to-eat meals that are on the table in less than 2 minutes. They're fresh, they're not frozen, they're chef-crafted and dietitian-approved. You eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. You just simply heat and savor the good stuff. And all these meals are really, really nutritious. They're macro-friendly if you're tracking your macros. That's another reason why I like them. So we've been using Factor Meals for a while. One thing I've enjoyed lately is the green chili chicken. Super tasty. I also like the creamy mushroom chicken and rice. Very good. It also comes with garlic green beans. And again, you just warm these things up in 2 minutes, and then you have this really delicious meal. And best of all, clean up's a breeze. If you want to try this out, head to factormeals.com/manliness50 and use code manliness50, that's manliness50, to get 50% off your first month plus 20% off your next month. That's a good deal. That's code manliness50 at factormeals.com/manliness50. Get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Check it out today. Have you ever been to an event where you just had to get the best seats? Like maybe it was a concert for your favorite band, or maybe it was an important game for your favorite team. Well, to do that, you had to set an alarm to get the tickets as soon as they went on sale. When you want the best, you have to act quickly, or someone else will get it instead. It's like if you are trying to hire for your business and you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. So what's the best way to do that? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best people fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/manliness, M-A-N-L-I-N-E-S-S. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. All right, picture that thing you've always wanted to learn. Now picture learning it from the person who's literally the best at it in the world. That's what you get with Masterclass. This year, learn from the best to become your best with Masterclass. Masterclass offers over 180 world-class instructors, and a lot of them are former AOM podcast guests. So for example, you can learn The Art of Negotiation from Chris Voss, we had him on the podcast, Leadership from Jocko Willink, another AOM podcast guest, Writing from Malcolm Gladwell, another AOM podcast guest. You name it, Masterclass has it. With Masterclass, you get unlimited access to intimate one-on-one classes with the world's best. Plus, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so there's no risk. So I did the Masterclass with Chris Voss on negotiation. Very well done. He talks about tactical empathy, how to mirror somebody so that you can develop rapport with them. So if you enjoyed that podcast I did with Chris Voss several years ago about his book, Never Split the Difference, you're going to love this Masterclass. And right now, AOM listeners will get an additional 15% off an annual membership at masterclass.com/AOM. Get 15% off right now at masterclass.com/AOM. masterclass.com/AOM. Check out the negotiation class with Chris Voss.
So, I mean, what, if a guy's like wanting to upgrade his wardrobe, what's like the go-to dress shoe that he should probably make his first investment in?
You need, one pair of, your very first shoe would be one pair of black leather lace-up shoes. That's an Oxford style shoe. Now there are various variations on the style, but it should be as simple as possible. You could have a toe cap or not. And my thing, and this is, a lot of people think this is a bit too extravagant, but my thing is they must have a leather sole. The leather sole makes them expensive. That means they're going to be probably over $250, maybe $300. The point about the leather sole is people can recognize it. It looks good. You could put on, take it to a cobbler and put a thin rubber layer over it so that it never wears out. You can keep replacing that rubber layer. And those shoes will last you forever. So that will be your first pair. Now, unfortunately, black shoes are kind of going out of fashion, as you probably noticed, but more and more people with suits are wearing brown shoes. This has really been the style for the last 10 years. And so your second pair of shoes should be brown or burgundy. They should also be plain. Although with brown shoes, you could go, the most ornate thing you can do is go to a brogue. A brogue is the shoe with the patterns made of punched holes in it. That's called broguing. Or tooling, that's called tooled leather. And so that would be your second pair.
Gotcha.
Basically, you need black and brown, leather soles, lace-up, not slip-on.
Okay.
Your third pair would be a pair of slip-on ankle boots, I would say, like Chelsea boots, which would be very useful for casual clothing.
Okay. Very good. Now, and what about suits? And I think you can kind of lay out like a suit ladder. I mean, a lot of guys,
right,
when they're thinking, okay, I got to get it. Most guys don't have a suit, which I'm surprised by this because a suit's so useful because you can wear it to job interviews or a funeral or a wedding. So for an all-purpose suit, for a guy who's buying his first suit, what color should he go for?
Right. There's only two you can choose from. Yeah, I'm giving you a choice of navy or charcoal. So charcoal is a very dark gray, not quite black. Now, either of those are appropriate for your first suit. You choose whichever you think matches your coloring best. But those suits are both very, very versatile. They can be worn in the day or in the evening. The reason I wouldn't choose black is that black tends to look a little bit cheap. I don't know why that is, but it's just not. It's just not a very respectable suit.
It looks like Reservoir Dogs, like the guys.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I mean, it looks a bit gangstery. It shows lint very badly, and it can be a bit shiny, and there's just something wrong about it. I can't quite put my finger on what it is, but you need something that's dark but not quite black. Now, it's very important that your first suit be dark, even if you live in a warm place like Los Angeles. I think that a light suit is not at all versatile and is going to look silly and casual in certain situations. The dark suit is much more versatile. Once you have two suits, once you have a navy and a charcoal, then you can move on to buying a summer suit in a lighter color. Don't get light gray until you've really got a bunch of suits. Now, those, the navy and the charcoal can be paired with an almost infinite variety of shirts and ties, and again, black or brown shoes, depending on how dressy you want to be. Traditionally, a black shoe is the most formal, although even that is changing. You know, recently here in Canada, we just had an election and a new prime minister was elected, and he is a very young prime minister. He's in his 40s. Mm-hmm. And he shocked everyone by going to his inauguration ceremony in a navy suit and brown shoes. I think this was the first time that it ever been done. And a lot of people complained that it seemed disrespectful and informal, but that's the way things were going. It was a bit for us like the moment when John F. Kennedy showed up at his inauguration in 1961 without a hat. I mean, now that was quite a daring step.
Well, it's interesting. You talk about this in the book. I mean, this is kind of going off the point of the history of men's style. Like, usually the changes in style are made by political leaders. So there's like a way you're supposed to do things. And I guess the Windsor, you know, he was like the guy who kind of propagated the Windsor knot. And then like one of the kings in England, he started wearing things a little more casually and people were stunned that he did it. But then a year later, that's what everyone was doing.
Well, yeah. I mean, probably the most famous example of that would be Prince Albert, Queen Victoria's son, who became Edward VII. He was a daring guy in that he behaved like a bit of a playboy, and he went to racetracks and he hung around with actresses and Americans. And so people were interested in his lifestyle because he was something of a celebrity. And so people started following his clothing. He had this, their house in Scotland, Balmoral, and he loved to go spend a lot of time there because he liked to shoot and hunt. And so he started wearing plaid, which was a Scottish influence. And plaid became all the rage in Victorian England, really because of Prince Albert. That's why we have so much plaid in our wardrobes now. It comes from his adventures in Scotland. He also had a little bit of a weight problem, and he liked to eat a lot. And he would wear a waistcoat, a vest, as part of his suit with many buttons. And apparently at the end of his meals, he would be so stuffed he'd unbutton the last button on his vest, on his waistcoat. And this became a fashion. And to this day, we never do up the bottom button of our waistcoat, just the same way we don't do up the bottom button of our suit jacket. This was all Prince Albert's influence. And then the next would-be king, who was Edward VIII, who abdicated and became the Duke of Windsor, was a very, very popular fashion plate. The popular papers were always photographing his style. And, of course, this was just the time when photographic magazines were first becoming popular. And so he was photographed everywhere, always wearing elegant, natty suits. And both of those guys did a lot to casualize men's clothing. They started toning down some of the more formal wear. So, for example, Prince Albert, at that time, one would wear a white tie to dinner in the evening. That is, a long tailcoat and a white tie and a white waistcoat, the most formal outfit there is. And at Balmoral, he started having more casual dinners where he would wear a shorter jacket and a black tie, which was very dressy down. And that became the modern tuxedo. It's all going less formal.
So, I mean, if royalty was the thing, the group that dictated style changes or fashion styles for men, what's our royalty today? I mean, who are the men that drive the changes in men's style?
Well, obviously, it's celebrities. It's popular entertainers. It's singers. It's actors. I think singers more than anything. And there's been a great revolution against convention and tradition that's really democratized fashion. And so the influences are coming from everywhere now. I don't think you can say there's any one there's any one source that one looks to on how to dress. And that makes that's better for the world generally, in that it makes it a more democratic place with fewer class barriers and shibboleths. At the same time, it means it makes it a little bit more confusing for men who are trying to decide how to dress. And there are various movements going on that could only be described as conservatism, that are dandy movements that are encouraging men, and African American men in particular in the United States, to espouse fine and conventional clothing, suits and ties and pocket squares in a very colorful and flamboyant manner. There's an interesting movement in Africa going on right now that you've probably heard of called the Sapeurs. The Sapeurs were a group of very underprivileged men from the Congo who'd spent all of their money on hand-tailored suits and ties in very bright colors, and leather shoes and all kinds of accoutrements like canes and hats. And they looked like very old-fashioned dandies. And it's a form of social rebellion for them. It's a form of kind of trying to move themselves out of the sense of lack of privilege that they have to be noticed in the world. And those guys have presences in other European capitals, like Paris in particular. So there's all kinds of strange explosions going on right now of kind of a defiant interest in a luxurious and flamboyant way of men's dressing.
Right. I mean, and we wrote this book a couple of years ago. I mean, are you surprised by some of these changes that are happening, or did you kind of see it was like the writing on the wall?
No, I'm not. I mean, I did say we're emerging out of this period of in which we value the all natural, and we have started to embrace artistry and an artifice again. I could kind of see this coming. I mean, I didn't see coming counter movements like normcore, you know, there'll always be a counterweight to anything like this.
Right. And for our listeners who aren't like normcore is like when people dress like Jerry Seinfeld, basically, right?
Normcore is, it may be a purely fictitious movement invented by the media. The idea of the metrosexual was largely invented by the media, actually, as well. The actual metrosexual was rarely seen in the wild, more in the pages of newspapers and magazines. I think the same goes for normcore. The idea is that the most fashionable and cool of hipsters in the urban centers of North America, and particularly in Brooklyn, decided to reject fashion so completely that they began to embrace a kind of anti-fashion which involved deliberately ugly and bland clothes. So to look not like a hipster, but like a tourist from the Midwest, with running shoes and plain jeans, maybe acid wash jeans and a t-shirt with a logo on it, and maybe a windbreaker. That's the idea of the blandest and most unnoticeable of all. That would be the highest fashion of all. And that's called Encore.
The irony.
You know what?
It makes my brain hurt.
Deep levels of cool, yeah.
Right. I'm curious. I mean, what do you think the future is of men's style? Because it seems like it's been stuck, like sort of the same thing for the past 100 odd years, a little 100 plus years, where it's a suit, yeah, white shirt, tie. I mean, are we ever going to move beyond that? Or are we kind of reached the apex?
Isn't that fascinating?
Like, I mean, it's really weird because, like, I mean, you look at, like, just like in the revolutionary times, like they're wearing like breeches and like, you know, yeah, frock coats and like these, like, very flamboyant things, wigs. And like, we're done. And I guess it's like, I don't know what's going on, decadence. Like we reached the apex and we're just going to stick there.
It's very strange how long this has stayed without any change at all. That Western standard, the Western standard too, has spread to the rest of the world as well. So it's incredibly powerful and fixed. And you know what? Fashion itself has been trying to fight it against it for decades. So you get high-end fashion designers, runway fashion, every year doing shows in which outrageous and groundbreaking outfits are thrown down the runway, men in completely crocheted outfits, men in skirts. I mean, for how many years have you been hearing there's about to be a revival of men wearing skirts? I've been hearing this since the 1980s. I remember going to fashion shows when I lived in Paris as a student in 1985 and seeing men in skirts walk down the runway and thinking, aha, finally men are going to wear skirts. Well, every 5 years we see someone say it's coming back, and it never, ever, ever does because fashion is always at odds with this very powerful force of convention in the sense that a man must look a certain way in order to play a certain role. And I don't see that changing anytime soon. I think that certainly our ideas of gender are slowly changing. Our ideas that that gender is fixed and has to be defined in a certain way is slowly changing. So maybe we'll see some more androgyny in men's fashion in future years. I think that's gradually happening, but not nearly as fast as anyone would have expected. So I don't know the answer to that, and I can't give it. I think you should go and buy suits now. They'll be good for the next 20 years.
There you go. And I mean, you talk about going back to sort of the practicalities of style. You mentioned you don't really you don't advocate spending a lot on clothing. So should guys invest in like a custom made suit or made to measure off? I mean, what if they're buying clothes, should they not feel bad going to a good department store that has good brand suits there and buying that and getting it tailored to fit, or should they go custom made?
That's a good question. And both are good. Nowadays in most cities, there are brand new businesses developing as we speak and proliferating, specializing in custom suits. And what they're doing is they will take your measurements, and then they will send those measurements off to Asia somewhere. It will either be China or India or Pakistan or Vietnam, where there are tailors working, and they will cut a certain pattern, but to your size. It's not all that different, really, from buying a suit off the rack. And you're not getting an actual bespoke suit. You're not actually getting a suit that's cut to fit you. You're getting a slight modification on an existing pattern. It's still in a very, very good deal. And those suits are hardly more than suits off the rack from a great department store. So I would say yes, it is. That suit probably will fit you a bit better, and it's not a whole lot more expensive. And so I would get yourself a made-to-measure suit. The top-end tailors tend to distinguish, they all have a different vocabulary, but here they tend to distinguish between made-to-measure and bespoke. So made-to-measure means what I've just described. They're giving you a slightly different size of an existing pattern. A bespoke suit is something much higher end, and it's where they're going to start from scratch and draw you a suit and cut it for you. I know here in Toronto, a suit like that will start at about $5,000. So that's not what I'm talking about. I would also say that there's nothing wrong with buying cheap, quick fashion from trendy chains, like, say, Zara or H&M, because it makes one feel good to have a natty suit that's in fashion. It's not going to last you forever. It's not going to be the best quality, but that's okay because the style is not going to last forever. And I'm talking about suits that are going to cost you, say, $300, $400. I think that if you're strapped for cash, it's really worth it to have one of those. Buy a new one every couple of years. Spend a lot of money on your shoes, on your shirt, and on your tie, and nobody will notice that you have a cheap suit on.
Gotcha. Okay, great advice there. Well, Russell, besides writing about style, you also write short stories. Can you tell us a little bit about your latest collection of short stories and where listeners can find out more about your work?
Yeah, I'm a novelist, and I've written several novels. My last novel was a book called Girl Crazy, and my most recent collection is a book of short stories, and it's called Confidence. And it's about urban people who live in cities and have affairs and do terrible things to each other. And so it's a funny and sad book. And you can get it on Amazon. But you can also check my website, which is russellsmith.ca.
Fantastic. Well, Russell Smith, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
My guest today was Russell Smith. He's the author of the book Men's Style, The Thinking Man's Guide to Dress, and that's available on Amazon.com. And you can find more information about Russell's work at russellsmith.ca. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness website at artofmanliness.com. And if you enjoy this podcast, I'd really appreciate it if you give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. As always, appreciate the support. And until next time, this is Brett McKay telling you to stay manly.
Hot off the press from Maybelline, New York, it's new Lifter Plump, an intense plumping lip gloss formulated with chili pepper to deliver a heated sensation for an instant plumping effect that lasts. From 8 sizzling shades like Blush Blaze, Red Flag, Hot Honey, Cocoa Zing, and more. An extra large wand applicator transforms lips in one swipe. Learn more at Maybelline.com. For a limited time, get 10% off your Lifter Plump purchase on Amazon with code 10PLUMP.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.